This is a series on whatever happened to, taking some subjects that have been in the news and have been influential in one way or another in American religious and political life, sort of a combination of both in the last 10 to 20 years, and sort of bringing them up to date and asking what kinds of questions, what difference do they make, you know, in our life. And today we want to talk about moral majority as an example of what I call, and many others call, the new Christian right. And then if we have time, say some things about TV preachers. And then tomorrow we'll be on the new, what I call the, a lot of people call it, the born again movement. Remember in 1976, Time magazine, even on its cover, talked about 1976 being the year of the evangelical. Everybody got all excited. I call it the 3C syndrome. It was Jimmy Carter, Eldridge Cleaver, and Charles Colson. Remember the one who would walk over his grandmother's body if Nixon had told him to, and then repented and spent some time in jail for good reason, and is now out working very strongly in prison reform and this sort of thing. And whatever happened to them, you know, things like Phyllis Schlafly or Anita Bryant, whatever happened to Anita Bryant, whatever happened to Maribel Morgan. Remember the good old days that we talked here, remember you people giggling so much over Maribel Morgan and Total Woman. And things like that, but bringing them up to date because some very important things are happening in the evangelical born-again movement today. Some very important things, and I want to update that and you know, go ahead with that. And then on Thursday, what I call religion and public life, the whole not just a school prayer thing, I think we all are familiar enough with that so that nobody's going to change anybody's mind in here on that one. I think that's been set, but all kinds of things like equal access, moment of silence, manger scenes in public, squares, Christmas carols in the high schools, all kinds of easy, non-controversial subjects like that one. In Rochester, near where I live, people still aren't talking to each other over the battle over having Christmas carols in the public schools. So I have a lot of students from Rochester, and they you know, bring me information about this. And then Friday, which will be at a different time on Friday, we're moving some of these around. Be sure to watch the bulletin board. Mine will be on 4 o'clock on Friday, will be on the Charismatic Movement. Because that, I looked at some of the tapes I had here. I had 4 tapes one year on the Charismatic Movement, and it's still alive and thriving in many ways and has made some changes. So much for, you know, so much for the commercials. I would like also to encourage as many people as possible to speak up. Some of you know I talk fast, and just give me a flag with your hand if I'm going too fast or if you have questions along the way, clarification. Save the heavy artillery, you know, as we like to call it, going to the mat, you know, till the end. I remember once I was doing the new Christian right at a conference at, I think it's August Donaldson Church in Denver, right? Isn't that a big LCA church right in downtown Denver, if I'm not mistaken? And yeah, they have the wonderful, or in a way, serious problem of having bought the land there about 25 years ago, and on their parking lot, now it's worth about $1 million an acre. And you know, what? That'd be a nice problem. What do you do with that? Should you sell it and give it to the, you know, use it for charitable purposes, or you know, what should you do with that? But anyway, I was talking to it was a weekend kind of thing, and it happened to be the Denver president of the John Birch Society was a member of the church, and he was in the front row, as you can readily imagine. And right away, as soon as the question period came, he was ready with words like treason and, you know, a few other things, and he was ready to, you know, to start right in. And my answer was, let's not go to the mat right away. You know, if you've watched wrestlers, especially college wrestlers, they sort of spar around for a while and take their time. We don't want to get down on the grunt and groan stuff, you know, the first minute. Wait for the last kind of thing with that. I'm talking about college wrestlers, not the professionals and so on. So this is what I call a go to a mat question. If you want to go to the mat, just wait, you know, a little bit till we get towards the end, because I think there'll be more time for that. And I do want to see how this comes out, because I'm scattered around here today more than usual, which some of you may not think is possible, but there are so many new things happening all the time that it's hard to sort of to keep up to date, and this will be pretty much more an anthology kind of thing rather than any kind of integrated or organized lecture. My students would tell me that none of my lectures have been integrated or organized anyway. Do I have Rich around here? He's probably listening on the tape. He's the head of the tapes, is one of my majors from St. Olaf, so anyway. Let's go on this. Moral majority and TV preachers. I mention this because in 1979 and in 1980, when the moral majority was announced and when we talked a lot about television preachers electronic evangelism, as it sometimes called, was called and still is called, a lot of people raised all kinds of questions as to what was going to happen to both American politics and American religious life because of the TV preachers. Falwell would be the most obvious example because he became president of Moral Majority. But others, Pat Robertson with the CBN or 700 Club, Jim Baker, our old friend Rex Humbard from Akron, Ohio, is still alive and flourishing. Tim LaHaye, Vice President of Moral Majority, and others you could mention. Okay, serious questions were raised as to the strengths, the impact that these people would have on American religious and American political life. And now, by the time we're into the new presidential campaign, I think it's time, and we have enough of material, enough of a track record, for both the Moral Majority as a political action group. And the TV preachers, the ones I want to be talking about. I'm not talking about who's the fellow down in Florida. Oh, for goodness, who?
Florida.
No, there's now Schuller. I talked about last week. He's not into this group at all. There's a fellow in Florida. Yeah, James Kennedy. That's right. Coral Gables, isn't it? I think. Yeah, right. Except I'm not talking about the Schullers or those, but those who are more in what we call the fundamentalist evangelical sphere. Okay. What has happened and what has happened up since about 1980 and what is happening right now, I want to talk especially in some detail about the new group called Americans Concerned for Traditional Values as an example for where the Moral Majority and the TV preachers are now. And then, a couple words maybe about the future. As a historian here, it's fun to indulge myself when I'm out of the classroom to talk about the future. As Mark readily knows, over there we aren't supposed to talk about the future, but, Holden, and holding all things are possible. Okay. I like to put a couple of titles on the board, especially if you're interested in doing further reading on this or else for your parish library. And the best book, and it's one of the it's best in one way because it has the most recent and updated scholarship. Robert Wuthnow is an editor, along with some others, of a very good book, The New Christian Right, put out by Aldine, which is a small but good publishing firm out of Chicago. 1983, that's an excellent book, gives a good balance of the whole thing of the New Christian Right. When you see, if I'd say NCR, I'm referring to New Christian Right. I'm not referring to, National Cash Register or anything along that line. And another, Americans Concerned for Traditional Values, Act V or whatever. And another one which has just come out and I'm working my way through, and it's written by a well-known Lutheran pastor and activist and writer, Richard John Neuhaus. Has a new book out, The Naked Public Square by Erdmans, just 1984, and I want to recommend that one also because he comes at it from the categories of Lutherans. And it was kind of fun, just as I was reading the book, to look at the ABC show right before the San Francisco convention, and they were showing some of the more tumultuous Democratic conventions, and they were showing the most tumultuous one of all, obviously the one in 1968. And there, from the New York delegation, was a young, clerically garbed delegate who was being carried out by the Chicago police for some particular reason. Daley liked to keep harass some of the people he didn't like, you remember, and it was kind of fun to see, would you believe a Lutheran clergyman being so activist that the Chicago police had to, take him out bodily, and we'll say a little bit more about Neuhaus as we go along. Okay, Moral Majority comes, just a couple words of background, I'll talk first about the Moral Majority as such. Moral Majority is the most important of the new Christian right groups. There are several others, Christian Voice, American Christian Heritage Foundation. I got a telephone call about 3 weeks before I came here, tape message from Tom Landry talking about things, and then at the very end, wouldn't you be happy to send $50? And I wouldn't have been happy to send $50 because I didn't have $50 to send, among other things. And then, well, how about 20? And then I said, I'd like to know more about the organization because, so many of these begin to sound alike. American Christian Heritage Foundation, that could be a front for all sorts of different things. And I sent for information, and I'm hopefully going to receive that, by the time I get back in about 2 weeks. Okay. Moral Majority comes into being in 1979, riding the crest of the, what I would call the conservative resurgence all during the 1970s. The 60s with the various liberation movements, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the peace movement, anti-war movement, the ecological movement, and all this was certainly dominant in the 1960s in terms of the politics, but all the time there was what I like to call the politics of resentment building up against us. Some people have forgotten, for instance, that even in 1968, George Wallace, who was running very much on a resentment policy or program, you know, we'll get those bureaucrats in Washington kind of thing, actually, and very much a regional candidate, was able to attract over 1 million votes, indicating that there was some sort of substratum of support and foundation for what I would call a resentment kind of politics. This continued to grow in the 1970s, and it continued to expand for two reasons, primarily because the issues became more intensified. In 1973, we have the well-known Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade, on legalizing abortion, and that probably more than anything else was a stimulus or a catalyst to continued political organizational growth by what will become the New Christian Right. Furthermore, the New Christian Right got out ahead of other action groups in the 1970s by the use of computers and direct mailing. Very successful there, the name of Richard Viguerie, I'm sure rings a bell with some of you, a direct mail computer wizard out of Fall Rivers, Virginia, a suburb of D.C., and had the money, had the know-how, and had the audacity, really, and I say that as a compliment, to expand direct mailing through computerized lists of potential donors, and had, by 1976, put together a rather substantial number of right-wing, conservative, traditionalist-oriented kinds of action groups. And some people forget, for instance, in 1976, that Ronald Reagan gave Gerald Ford a very serious run in the primaries. Already, the more as I'm looking at Ford, obviously, as somebody in the middle of the stream for the Republican Party, and already the stream that would surface very strongly in 1980 was clear, was evident, and was in motion, so to speak, by 1976. Gaining more names on the computerized list and gaining more money and gaining more skill on how to organize and mobilize voters. And that was very important, and I think that's probably the technological secret for the success of groups like Moral Majority. They simply had all these various names and knew how to reach them. I'm sure many of you are on mailing lists, as I am, for many groups of all different kinds of political and religious persuasions. And if you're like me, as I think I mentioned yesterday, you like to keep a waste paper basket very near your mailbox. As the case Mark knows at St. Olaf, we're very fortunate. It's 1.5 steps from my mailbox over to a very big drop at the receptacle for all that sort of thing. But a lot of people take this very seriously, and I do in terms of the documents which I receive through the mail itself. Okay, what happens then is one particular wing of what we call the New Right decides to go public, so to speak, come out of the closet in the late 1970s, 1980s through the Moral Majority. That is to organize and put into direct political action that which we call the fundamentalist evangelical wing in American Protestantism. That was a revolution, really, in every sense of the word, because for a long period of time, fundamentalists and many evangelicals thought what was necessary was to keep the faith pure, pure doctrine, teachings like this, and to avoid political involvement because that would be compromised with the secular world. Politics is the art of the possible, as the old expression goes, and I'll talk about that in a little way, in a little different sense in a minute. And they all thought of politics as compromise, of having to deal with people whom you disagreed with. But if you've seen the light, if you have the true faith, as fundamentalists believe, and all the rest, then there's no need to, and in fact it is wrong to compromise with those who don't share your same particular religious and doctrinal and value kinds of commitments. I found that, for instance, when I wrote the first book, The Politics of Doomsday, with the likes of old friends like Carl McIntyre and Billy James Hargis and others like that. That's one reason they never made a dent into politics, was that they saw politics as demeaning and as below them, requiring kind of this kind of compromise. But not so with the new group. Falwell announced in 1979 that his earlier decision on staying out of politics was what he called a false prophecy or a false message, and he openly and flatly reversed this and said that what's necessary for the survival of the Republic is for fundamentalists and evangelicals to get directly involved in the electoral process, in registering voters, getting them out to vote, in endorsing certain kinds of candidates. Now, you say, well, what about you know, separation of church and state and tax-exempt organizations. It's not possible, or it's illegal, put it the other way. It's illegal for religious-oriented groups to endorse specific candidates, or you'd lose your tax-exempt status. What they worked out, and it's all completely legal, some of the critics of Moral Majority forgot this for a while, what they worked out was the appearance of a group, a political action group like Moral Majority, which is not tax-exempt. That has to be said right from the beginning. It's not tax-exempt. People, they never claimed to be tax-exempt. They had you know, very skillful lawyers who worked this out so that there's no particular, you know, legal or constitutional issue there. But they decided to go political. And in 1980, some of you remember, and I'll just say one or two more things on historical background, then get to where we are in 1984. In 1980, they tried with two particular kinds of tactics to get directly involved. One was what we call, you know, in mafia terms, the hit list, or sometimes the candidate list of those who they would, you know, spend a great deal of time and attention and money on in order to defeat. And they chose six liberal Democratic senators in 1980, Birch Bayh, George McGovern, let's see, the red around there, Iowa was, oh for goodness sake, oh, it'll come to me, McGovern, Birch Bayh, Frank Church, Alan Cranston, oh, who, I've forgotten Iowa, it's been a while. But anyway, they chose, and in Wisconsin it was not Proxmire, the other Democrat, Gaylord Nelson, that's the one, yeah, Gaylord Nelson, sure. They chose to put their efforts on these, and five of the six were defeated, but as it turned out in the analysis later on, that these five would have been defeated whether or not Moral Majority or any of the other groups had gotten involved at all. Birch Bayh was in Indiana at a time when the unemployment was at its worst. Frank Church in Idaho had been spending all his time with the Foreign Relations Committee and had not tended his fences back home. Alan Cranston did win in 1980, you remember, or was reelected, and so on. But the New Christian Right claimed victory for this and saw this as a vindication of what they were trying to do. The other thing was the Moral Report Card, in which they would rate all the congressmen or the congresspeople on the on a list of 10 issues. And guess what? Jesse Helms got 100, and guess what? George McGovern got a 0, to the surprise of nobody, I think, you know, on this one. And that's understandable because both represent, you know, the extreme opposites in terms of their political commitments. But when somebody like Mark Hatfield of Oregon, one of the leaders, you know, in the whole evangelical movement, got, I think, about a 40, then people begin to wonder what kind of, you know, an evaluation this was, because Hatfield's interest in the, you know, in the peace movement and some of the other things. Okay, so the Moral Majority got what they wanted, I think, in 1980. It got attention, you know, that old journalistic thing, I don't care what you say about me as long as you spell my name right. And it got the national attention that it wanted, and it proved also that it could raise money, and it proved also that it could bring together large numbers of right-wing single-interest groups, all the right to, the pro-life groups, the National Rifle Association, and all the other handgun legislation groups. All of these, among others, the ecological groups, came together in a successful effort to convince the American public that conservatives could get along. And that was news in American politics. I have to deviate here slightly, because conservatives oftentimes, until 1980, spent more time arguing among themselves than it did in going after the opposition. Because conservatives tend to have very strong, you know, political and moral convictions. And they like to think that these are true for all people under all conditions, and therefore they could never really come to terms in getting together. Look at Barry Goldwater in 1964, the greatest loss that any presidential candidate has ever suffered. Lyndon Johnson got 60.2%, you know, of the total vote, because conservatives couldn't get together. Remember Nelson Rockefeller sitting it out, and all the different things, they just simply went their own way. But in 1980, conservatives decided to get together because they thought the issues were significant enough. Okay. And the Moral Majority got on the on the front pages. Jerry Falwell became a household word. He got on the Phil Donahue show and several of the others. Gary Collins, isn't that a show where he would come in and talk about family issues and some of the other things. And Falwell cultivated this very carefully. Last week I was talking about Billy Graham, and people said, who's going to be Graham's successor? Graham is in his mid-60s now. And what's happening, and it's very clear, is that Jerry Falwell is trying very hard to move more towards the center and become Mr. Conservative Protestant clergyman, you know, in the United States. And he wouldn't mind saying clergyman. He wouldn't at all be impressed with being called a clergy person because of the sort of the traditionalist kinds of values which are there. We can talk about later if you want. So he tried very hard, writing books, flying around the country, something like 200,000 miles a year, being on all kinds of letterhead organizations. You can always tell, you know, a pressure group when the word concerned is in there. It's no matter what it might be, concern for ecology or what, you know, what was it, the snail darter they were trying to save down in Tennessee? Americans concerned for snail darters, I think it was. Remember the ecological battle there over whether or not to finish a dam. Remember the millions of dollars that were spent over that. So he got involved in all these kinds of Americans concerned for this or that. They tried in 1982, and this is where I'm building up to. In 1982, they tried the hit list in the moral report card technique once more, and they worked with another groups, some of the PAC groups or the political action groups, and they put, they did silly things like putting Teddy Kennedy on the hit list, and you know, that's just a waste of money, as they found out about October. There was no way. I mean, the old expression is true: Teddy Kennedy could have won if he had run on the laundry ticket, and rather than, you know, any other kind of ticket. And they pulled their money back there, but they concentrated on two other candidates, liberal Democrats, Paul Sarbanes of Maryland and Doc Melchior here over, or the senator from Montana. And what happened was that their techniques failed. In Sarbanes, they turned some of their, as we like to call them, loose cannons on Sarbanes, and so exaggerated and distorted his record that the poll started to show that Sarbanes was getting people who simply were fed up with the kinds of conservative reactionary, you know, TV one-minute spots that were going on there. And Sarbanes was delighted. He said, you know, keep these television programs rolling, because they could prove it. In the last week, they pulled them off, but it was too late. And that's important, as we'll see in a minute. The other one was Doc Melchior here, or Dr. Melchior. It's a veterinarian, and that's important, in Montana. They decided they were going to go after him, and Melchior turned this around very nicely. He started having his own TV spots showing people landing at the airports in wherever it might be, Butte or Missoula or all the other places, carrying suitcases, and he said, here come all those Eastern big money bags out to spend money to get your old favorite doctor, you know, Melchior, out of Montana. He said, let's have Montana money for Montana campaigns. Let's not have all this big East Coast money coming in, because they were bringing in more of a majority, and the others were bringing in lots of money and spending money for, you know, the TV spots. And Melchior said, I'm just plain old Doc Melchior. And he showed himself, you know, with his old veterinarian bag and his four buckle overshoes, as you know, as vets have to use when they go in the cow barn, and coming back with you know what on their on their overshoes and all the rest. And it worked, and it worked very well, just as the Sarbanes thing worked also. So what I'm getting at is that in 1984, the hit list sort of thing is almost passé. This is no longer a viable kind of tactic, and I think it's largely because of what happened with Sarbanes and happened with Melchior in Montana. Instead, what happened, and I should look at my notes, yeah, here we go. What happened in 1984 was something which is new, and which can be, I think it's too early to tell how, you know, long range, how significant it's going to be, but it gives the indication of being a new kind of political, moral tactic in American religious, organized American religious life, and American political life also. This would be the whole new drive to organize specific groups of voters according to their interests. There's no, and a lot of it, and I'll mention this in a little more detail later, there's no question about that. It got started when Jesse Jackson started registering blacks. This is where it really began. Jackson declared his candidacy, you remember, in November, I think it was, and started saying that he would go around, started organizing black congregations in different parts of the country, and that has happened. As far as we can tell, there's probably somewhere between 2.5 million or 3 million blacks who have been registered because of the new activities that are going on there, both in the urban areas like Chicago and Detroit, and also in the Deep South. And there's no question, I think all of you in one way or another are probably still out there and heard you know, the speech of Jackson, or know something about it. He's not in the conservative camp. I think that's the safest statement I'll make today. And as oftentimes, as usually happens in politics, you generate a clear position, generates almost its opposite. And others started seeing the potential danger with something like Jesse Jackson, because he could bring in votes that had never been used before. And people also remember, and parenthetically on here, the potential here for a drastic change, because you remember in 1980, only, what was it, 53.2% of all eligible voters voted in 19, you know, at that time, 53.2%. And Reagan got 27%. He won in a landslide in the Electoral College, but he got 51%, and then that means 49% the American public didn't vote for. That was frightening to some people, because it wasn't quite the trend that some of the journalists, or the, you know, as I say, the landslide that some journalists made it out to be. So they realized what we, you know, the people on all the different, you know, sides of the political spectrum started to think, what can we do to capitalize on this situation where something like 45% of the American voter, potential American voters, aren't even voting. And what they found especially was they were some of the people in the poorer groups, and also some of the younger voters, potential voters, simply weren't voting. So they had to find some new technique, some new program to do this. And what they came up with was, in a way, an imitation, or certainly a closer imitation, I think, of Jackson's group. And the Moral Majority and some of the others came up with a group which was announced in June of this year, Americans Concerned for Traditional Values. Okay, this is the point where I want to get at for today. This is a well-organized, well-financed program on the part of most of the well-known TV evangelist preachers to use especially the more fundamentalist and evangelical congregations in order to, you know, to register voters, to get them on the lists and get them interested in the issues. And then on election day, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, as it always is in this country, to turn them out. And this was announced, and again, the leader here was Jerry Falwell. This is what I'm saying, I think the Moral Majority and the other groups are putting their emphasis on now rather than the old hit lists, although there is a group called Christian Voice, which will publish its hit list a little bit later, but in the Moral Report card, but most of them aren't in here. And okay, another thing that's fascinating about ACTV, or Americans Concerned for Traditional Values, is that it is brought together in a nicely organized fashion most of the leading TV preachers. It's not only Falwell who's in the group, but it's Jimmy Swaggart, and it's also Jim Baker, Tim LaHaye, Oral Roberts is in it, Rex Humbard down in the Cathedral of Tomorrow, in Akron, Jack Van Imp, and some others. I've got some other names here. Bill Bright of Campus Crusade. Does that ring a bell with some of you? James Robeson, Kenneth Copeland, there's one. Don't start your day off with Kenneth Copeland if you ever turn on television. He is so angry about everything that he'll get your adrenaline, your negative adrenaline, if there is such a thing, you know, flowing in that particular direction. Okay, and the president of the Southern Baptist Association, Charles Stanley, and so on. Okay, they are announcing a program to organize as many and to register as many voters as possible. And there's no question here that this is done as a way of countering the work of what Jackson has been doing. And this is especially true, you see, in the South, because Reagan, when you put the whole, you know, Southern electoral pattern together, Reagan only won by 5% in the deep Southern states, which is not a comfortable margin given, you know, the nature of American politics. And when Jackson comes in and openly and consciously and proudly goes for, you know, the black vote, obviously there has to be some counterbalance to this, and this is what's taking place right now. I suggested when I talked about Reagan last week something which I think is true. Reagan has already made his move into organizing the White South, showed up in on July 4th when he went to the Daytona Firecracker. You remember the 400, and there simply aren't any blacks who participate. You don't, you know, A.J. Foyt and Tom Sneva and all the rest of them, you simply don't find any black participation there, but that's the one sort of American place that Reagan decided to appear at in July 4th. And then after that, for his rally, he spoke in Decatur, Alabama, a town of 7,000. Well, the point is, politicians usually go where the most voters are. It's an old, and necessary kind of tactic. But he chose Decatur, Alabama, because it's very much in the heart of the deep white South, and it's an effort, you see, to counterbalance the inroads, which has obviously been made by the Jackson forces. So Actville is up and moving, and it has been endorsed. And I've got their National Voter Registration Leadership Manual here. And if you want to write, it's a San Diego, you have to San Diego post office box, and I've got the, you know, I've got the 800 number, 824, and then what else? You know, 1776. It's easy to remember. You identify, you know, with the American Revolution. And then the inside cover to Tim LaHaye, President Reagan says this: "Unlike communist states and other totalitarian systems that offer no such liberty, Americans afford each of us a chance to make our voice heard through the ballot box. This freedom of choice is one of the traditional values we often take for granted. Your group of concerned religious leaders has taken the important step of founding the nonpartisan American Coalition for Traditional Values. This has the potential to speak for millions of committed Christians who, while they don't lack patriotism, have for one reason or another never gotten involved in politics." Then he skips a little. "In 1980, concerned Americans played a major role in the victory of many candidates who stand for traditional values. The nation needs the same level of commitment even more in 1984 if our freedoms are to remain secure. In 1984, America's promise can be rewarded by millions of Americans dedicated to traditional values. As your president, I thank you and your colleagues for your faithful patriotism. Please continue working to get eligible men and women in your area registered to vote, and then do all you can to make sure that they go to the polls on election day." So the new direction, you see, of what I call the new Christian right, I think, is fairly clear as to where they'll be putting their energy and attention in this particular year. Okay. Bill Bright and all the rest of things. There are some variations. Pat Robertson, you haven't heard his name yet. Robertson was 700 Club or Christian Broadcast Network, didn't get into this. He's got another group which is called Freedom Council, and that would indicate something where I would want to make the transition now, that it may well be that most of the heavy artillery, the, you know, the big cannons of are involved with ACTV, but not all of them, which would indicate that television preachers still attempt to differentiate themselves wherever possible, so that they will be able to bring forward and hold, you know, supporter loyalty for their particular causes. If it gets to be just one big movement, then people might start, especially new potential donors, might start confusing Baker with Robertson, or Falwell with Swaggart, or with some of the others. And therefore, as is the case in any merchandising operation, you have to have product differentiation. Product differentiation obviously will mean that people know to whom they're sending, giving their support, and to whom they are loyal. And I think Robertson has stayed out of it basically for that particular reason, although he would agree, I'm sure, ideologically with all the other positions that, you know, ACTV has taken on this. And since there is this incredible amount of money which is involved, obviously they have, you know, a great deal at stake. I think I mentioned, was it yesterday in here, that Robertson in 1983 took in over $100 million, which, you know, is a lot of petty cash, and all the rest. Okay, but let me sum up on this, and I want to use here the interpretation of Ken Woodward, who is a religion editor for Newsweek. "The creation of ACTV signals a new era in American religion and politics." There's, you know, that's a pretty strong statement. "A new era in American religion and politics. It demonstrates that the leadership of Christianity's new right is firmly in the hands of religious freelancers rather than representatives of the traditional Protestant denominations." I think that's true. The traditional Protestant denominations are not directly and heavily involved in the campaigns and the voter registration and all the rest of 1984. Good reasons for this, but we can talk about that later. The leadership of the new right is in the hands of religious freelancers, those who are not identified with a specific denomination. That's important. Okay. Rather than representatives of the traditional American denominations. And then he goes on to list some of the others, the main names I've mentioned here: James Robeson, Rex Humbard, Kenneth Copeland, Bill Bright, and others like this. Okay. So what we have, I think, then in this campaign is something of a shift in strategy and something of a shift in tactics. With these people who were doing one thing in 1980, seeing that it had its limitations, but firmly caught up in the momentum and the strength of the unquestioned power of, you know, the conservative movement, both in politics, in religion, and, you know, in the 1980s. You think back, as this one ABC television show did, on the 1968 campaign, and you see how things have changed. They did a wonderful thing. They showed the style of dress of the candidates to the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, and they dressed about the way we dress here. you know, coming to the convention and grubbies and all the rest. And all and now in 1984, you know, all three-piece suits and, you know, more conservative, traditional kinds of things, indicating a trend in culture as well as, I think, in politics and in religion in 1984. Now, a sort of a subdivision or a spin-off from this is what's happening in some of the state political parties. And I see a couple of Minnesota people here, and what I want to talk about briefly is what's happening in this particular state, since it's the state I come from. And if any of you have information about this same trend happening in any of your others, I'd be very happy to, you know, to listen to that, because I'm trying to do some research on this sort of thing. What's happened is that the momentum for the return to traditional values has inspired some political leaders to take on the more established, older political leadership in both the Republican Party, more in the Republican Party than the Democrat, but in both parties. Starting in 1982, we have the gubernatorial election in 1982, a candidate named Glenn Sherwood, who clearly was sympathetic to the traditional values approach, ran, and at the nominating convention got 30% of the vote. And a lot of people, the commentators and all the rest, breathed a sigh of relief, saying that's the peak for the moral majority kind of approach. That isn't going to go anywhere. It's going to sink. It's going to sort of, you know, go back into oblivion. But it didn't. What happened was that through organizations much like the one I've been talking about here, the more conservative, traditionalist-oriented evangelical people decided to get directly involved in the political process. And I can't speak for, you know, the other kinds of political operations in different states, but in Minnesota, they start with local precincts in the first Tuesday in March, if I'm not mistaken, is when it is. It's early in March. And you start electing, you have open forums, caucuses on issues, and you start electing people to county political campaign or conventions, then to district ones, your congressional district ones, and then to the state. And the conservatives were very well organized in Minnesota and had slates of candidates ready for all the levels, going from city to county to district and finally to the state. And by the time they got to the state convention in June of this year, which I attended, and as I've said to some of you, I really enjoy doing field research with this sort of thing, they were organized and had a clear set of alternatives in their platform to the more traditional kinds of ones that, let's say, the older Republican or the more middle-of-the-road Republican Party had in Minnesota itself. And it caught a lot of people by surprise because they thought that the movement had peaked in 1982, but it hadn't and in 1984, and has come out very strongly on some specific kinds of issues. And I have the resolutions ballot, and I wanted to read just a few of the statements here. Some of them would be things which, you know, many people would agree with. But some of these are a little bit more controversial. For instance, we support daily recitation of the, that was a joke, I'm sorry you didn't laugh, but recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag and the teaching of the basic principles of patriotism in all classrooms. And the seventh one is one which requires a little explanation, because there are sort of code words, as there are in any political or theological or moral kind of debate. There are certain code words here. Okay, this is the one. The Minnesota school system should continue the teaching and modeling, the key word there is modeling, and modeling of traditional American values. By modeling, they mean traditional sex roles between men and women, that the teachers there should model what has always been, or what has been, you know, the traditional roles as a clear indication for that. All right. Then one which Congress passed last week, we support the right of religiously motivated students in public schools to meet on school property on the same basis as other students. That's what we call the Equal Access Bill, and I want to talk about that on Thursday, and so on. Then homosexuality or prostitution not be legalized or otherwise promoted as an acceptable way of life. Injecting that, you see, for the first time into the political arena. That's a significant point here. And the question becomes, is the political arena the best place to resolve, you know, very highly emotional moral issues? Because politics depends so much on compromise rather than on other ways of solving problems. One other one here, where is it? Be it resolved that we ask for a repeal of the Minnesota state law mandating the fluoridation of public drinking water. I kind of thought that one had been put to rest, especially if you know what happened in Minnesota up at Brainerd. But it's back again. It's an indication of some of the new issues that were put forward. on this. In other things, creationism should have an equal footing with teaching of evolution, end to forced busing, and end to affirmative action, other things like this. Now, why is this significant? It may well be a flash in the pan, and that's in fact the tack that the Republican Party leadership in Minnesota is taking. And they're calling us, I called Dave Krogsing, the former chairman, about this, and he thinks it's just a flash in the pan, that when it comes time for, you know, the long haul, as we say in politics, are you going to be there to ring the doorbells? Are you going to be there to make the phone calls? Are you going to be there to take people to voting on voting day? Are you going to be there to stuff envelopes? Are you going to do all the grubby, ordinary, dull sorts of things, you know, 2 years from now or 4 years from now that have to be done in politics? Or is this just sort of a temporary, as they hope to hope it is, flash in the pan, where you get excited, you think you're really going to go down and put an end, for instance, to some of these things, and carry the you know, the day for the conservative cause? That's where, you know, the issue is right now, and what's happening with things like ACT TV is that they're beginning to get directly involved in this new kind of process. And you know, again, you can't say, you know, in the future what's going to happen, but clearly something very important is afoot right now in American politics, and I think it's coming from those who have stayed out of the mainstream of American political life for a long time. My own personal feeling on the Minnesota thing is that it took a little while, but then it dawned on me, I teach American history and I should know these things, the American political part, both, all parties, it doesn't have to be just the big two, all political parties are really open to everybody. There are some people who are saying, well, what are these fundamentalist people doing in politics? Isn't politics really the work of those, you know, who have been there for a long period of time? There's one alderwoman in Minneapolis, Carlson, who was outraged because she didn't get a spot on the convention to, you know, delegation to Dallas, and her whole point was, I've been a loyal, you know, professional Republican for 20 years, and these people come along and in 2 years, you know, vote me out. And the answer to that is that the political parties are open to everybody. And you can't start saying, well, fundamentalists shouldn't belong because of that, or people on the far left shouldn't belong. It belongs to everybody, and therefore politics should be a mirror of what's going on. And the only point I'm making is that it'll be interesting to see how long it will mirror some of these new trends. Okay, that's basically where I think the moral majority is going. I want to say just a couple things about TV preachers, and then we'll have time, maybe 15 minutes or so for discussion. Okay, when the TV preacher thing started up in 1979, 1980, there were two or three basic concerns, and these are in the book, for instance, that's here, that I wrote in 1981, as to what the TV evangelist would do so far as American organized church life was concerned. This was a very real, you know, problem in the minds of many people, and there was a great deal of alarm expressed over this. For instance, there were people in the stewardship office at the ALC who were worried because they found out that money from Lignite, North Dakota, ALC people, was going to Jimmy Swaggart rather than going to 426 South Fifth Street in Minneapolis. And that was Roel Kingdom, right? And he was one who encouraged me, in fact, to write The Politics of Moralism as one sort of response to that. And other kinds of concerns were expressed. It was so strong, in fact, that a lot of the concerned people decided that we should really get you know, solid, documentable information on what really has happened to American religious and political life on the basis of the influx of the TV preachers. And I'm talking about the big four or five here. I'm talking about Falwell, I'm talking about Pat Robertson, I'm talking about Jimmy Swaggart, and Jim Baker would be the most important ones. Others just below the surface. Kenneth Copeland would be one just below the surface, and Tim LaHaye and some of the others. And some people come up after my presentations on this and mention their particular people. There are a lot of other regional candidates, and some who don't get into politics at all. Peter Popoff, does that ring a bell? And I can't get off Peter Popoff's mailing list. He sent me handkerchiefs and said to me to put them over my head, and then I will be cured of whatever, you know, it's an all-purpose cure. Or another one, he's given me something to put on the floor, and I put my feet on them, and then I draw the size of my shoe when I send this back, and then when he gets it back in somewhere in California, he will stand down there also and pray for me, and the osmosis or whatever it is will cure whatever problem I have. You find a lot of strange people getting involved in politics and in religion. Peter Popoff, very sincere. What? I'm sorry.
What's his address?
His address. It would be in Southern California. No mistake about that. More unusual people. One of the favorite pieces of one of my favorite documents in American religious history is the Saturday night religion page of the Los Angeles Times, where they list all the services for all the different groups in Los Angeles for the next day or the next week. And talk about pluralism. You'll find it, you know, in abundance there. Okay. What happened was that all the different groups involved, Moral Majority, National Council of Churches, National Association of Evangelicals, American Civil Liberties Union, the Lutheran Church in America, no less, the Society of Friends, which would be Quakers, Mennonites, Christian Church, that would be the Disciples of Christ, the old Campbellites, Seventh-day Adventists and all the rest, got together and decided to sponsor an exhaustive study of the impact of TV preachers. And this was done through a highly reputable school, the School of Journalism in University of Pennsylvania. And they collected a good deal of money for the study. And in June of this year, the results were published. And I, you know, happen to have a copy. But I wouldn't recommend that you run right down to your local bookstore to find one, because all the tapes connected with all of it, to where it's all there, cost $500. And, you know, that's maybe not something that you have laying around the house and lose change. But the results of the study have been published in different forms. The one which may be the most accessible to you is in Christian Century for July 1824 of this this year, also in the most recent issue of Christianity Today. You notice how I try to have a balance between Christianity Today and Christian Century. There's, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll explain it afterwards. Those are representing sort of the two poles, really, in American Protestant life today. All right, what did they find? This is what's fascinating, and I want to get at. First of all, they found that the number of people who viewed religious television programming in this country was not anywhere near as much as many of the people like Falwell had claimed. Falwell claimed in 1980 that he had an audience of 25 million people. They call this in a fit of hyperbole, which is a nice way of putting it with Falwell. What they found was this, that there are about 4.84 million persons, or approximately 2.17% of the total population, who watch an hour or more of religious television per week. Not per day, but per week, because many of the shows, like Robertson and Jim Baker, and Swaggart is on every day too, isn't he? That's right, sure, out of Louisiana, okay. 2.17% of the total population watch an hour or more of religious television per week, which gives you some indication of the extent of this. That is of the total population of the whole country, not just the total population of people who watch television. Well, this sort of thing, okay. Second one, and I'll read it here, the electronic church is not effective at evangelism, but it is an effective reinforcer of existing religious beliefs of viewers. In other words, it doesn't convert new people, but it strengthens the convictions and the loyalties and the support of those it already has. That was something some people had sort of suspected all the way along. And I think it's good to hear and to know, I should say, that that's been confirmed. That, in other words, there are some people who turn to electronic evangelism, and I'm talking about these people. I'm not talking about Schuller, for instance, here, or any of the others who stay out of the political thing altogether, but I'm talking about these people. It's interesting to know that they do not convert new people to the cause, and that this suggests, and I think it's a fair and defensible interpretation on my part, see if I can remember, that people who people who started to support Robertson and Swaggart and Falwell and all the rest, did so primarily because they didn't hear from their own pastors and preachers what they wanted to hear. And they started to look around, and they finally found somebody who was saying what they wanted to hear, and that's where they stayed. And there reaches a time in television where there aren't that many sort of new people coming on. There are not that new people available anymore. Television has a way, really, of creating and then holding a certain kind of loyal constituency. When you feel your pastor or your friendly crusader, is off on some, is doing something that you want, you tend to support them, over a period of time, over a long period of time. And I think that's what's happened, that the electronic evangelists aren't converting new people. And that therefore, if there's reason to think that there won't be a significant number of new supporters coming in. But those who are already there are, what the word Terry used this morning, riveted in place.
and they will continue to support. And this suggests, in terms of strategy for mainline churches like Lutheran, Presbyterian, you know, Methodist, and all the rest, that it isn't going to be very possible, and it isn't even desirable, to try to reach those who have committed themselves to the TV evangelists. There are some people who simply aren't going to respond to this. And therefore, mainline television evangelism, such as Richard Jensen, some of you know, is doing with Lutheran Vespers, now should go for its own particular, try to market its own kind of market, and not try to be all things to all people. The Catholics are doing this too, and of course Missouri has done this for a long time with this program. This is your, isn't it? This is the Life, right? Those half-hour drama shows, which have been, you know, really successful in you know, in local areas, and not just St. Louis. Okay, so that's a very important part. Now, what about the matter of giving? What about the matter of money? The charge was made in 1980-81, and it's in my book too, that this would take TV evangelists would take money away from the mainline denominations. How in the world can Pat Robertson be getting $100 million a year and this not affect the ALC or the Methodist or, you know, Presbyterian or UCC kinds of budgets? The best evidence from the Pennsylvania study is that this hasn't happened. That where there has been decline in the mainline churches, and there's no question in the 70s and a little bit into the 1980s, that there has been a slight decline in membership, although both ALC and LCA went up in 1982. That's the last year we have good statistics for. About 1%, wasn't it, I think? I think that went up, so the trend of the 70s has been reversed. That particular trend of decline has bottomed out, and that the people who are still in the mainline denominations are continuing to send their financial support to their own denominations. And that money isn't going to the TV preachers, as some people like Roald Kindem and myself thought would happen. The money is coming from those who are committed to the kinds of ministries of Farwell and Swaggart and Robertson and Baker. And it's coming in increasing, increasing amounts. They know now how to raise funds. That's the point. They know how to raise funds. And I have to deviate here slightly. Did any of you see the, of course, maybe you don't watch Jim Baker, and I try not to as much as I can. But the time, I was just amazed. His television show about raising funds, God really loves it. God really feels good when you give money. I should check with Terry on God's suffering, about that. But then he had a song, I Started Living When I Started Giving to the Lord. And think about the implications of that for a while. And then there was one, he has a Hall of Fame program where if you give $1,000, if you're down in Charlotte and you come forward to the American Heritage Village, if you give $1,000, you come forward and you get a handshake from Jim, and they are taking videotape of you, and you'll be given a free videotape so you can go back, and he said this on the air, and show your neighbors back home that you came forward and got a handshake from Jimmy Baker. As though that should be the motivation for your giving $1,000. For this. The problem, you see, is clear, and the mainline churches know this, they can't use those kind, they would refuse to use those kind of, high-pressure tactics for fundraising. And there are some people who respond to these sort of things. And there's where the clash comes in. But they found, and then I'll just quit with that point, they found that the kind of money that they thought would be taken away from the mainline churches hasn't materialized, that fear. And what's happening is that the TV evangelists, those I'm talking about, have found new ways of, new ways of raising funds. I end with one other quotation or illustration. You begin to wonder, though, if this won't peak also, because I don't know what's left for Jim Baker for raising funds. He once had his biggest fundraiser for the year televised at the Open Tomb in, near Jerusalem. That's thinking big. If you really want to put on a spectacle, what could be a greater place than for a fundraiser than the Open Tomb? And you use that. And the next year, he outdid himself. He had it filmed in the upper room in Jerusalem. The only problem is nobody knows where the upper room really was. And it may well be buried, under all the archaeological stuff that has happened all the time. But, after Open Tomb and Upper Room, I don't know what's left. Zacchaeus's tree or something like this. There may be one other place. But anyway, I'd be glad for your comments. This is an interim report. Obviously, we are right into the middle of the new campaign. And all I can say is this is where it's at right now. Yeah.
I wonder if this study dealt with the question of how many people are really turned off to the church by these teachers.
Turned off by the church, yeah.
Because that's what I think, knowing a lot of real well-educated young people who will turn these on, and then just equate the church with all these ridiculous people, and then I'll find myself defending the church and saying, that's not all of us.
Yeah.
We're not all like that.
I'd want to, you know, I can go through some of the other material. I've got the, now I haven't got all the whole $500 report up at the room, but I've got a lot more of the statistical things, and I'll be happy to look at that, because that could well be. You say that's not, when you watch Jimmy Baker and you see Tammy Faye, you say that isn't really happening, is it? And it really is happening, yeah.
Did it, in demographics, did it describe who are the people that watch it?
Yeah.
I mean, are they like, my impression would be a retired person.
Older,
who has time to sit and watch and who's maybe lonely, and this is their companion.
Right, and lower income by comparison to others, lower educational level, a lot of housewives, for instance. This would be the daily one, not the Sunday morning one.
I think of the daily.
The daily ones, right. Pat Robertson and Jimmy Baker and the others like that. Yeah, they've got that fairly clearly defined, which is in here too. Yeah. Very, very nicely. The demographics are clear, sure.
I guess I'm not as worried about the moral majority donating money to registration of voters, because I think, in a way, if they're trying to get the women who are listening, the women vote on peace and justice issues, and I don't think they might go along with them as much as what they may think. And I also would like to say that RKO Radio is donating to the League of Women Voters, which I'm a member of, 100 million radio spots on registration.
Yeah,
and what we have to do is get out the word that there are two sides.
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make, is that the battle, the energy in 84 is going to be over voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much so. And the different groups, and sort of to recognize and identify these groups, and the strategy and the counter strategy that's taking place, right.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, as a citizen myself, I'm delighted with anybody who decides to register and to vote.
Yeah, I'm not worried about that as much as their concentration on competing issues.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Thank you. Yeah.
Maybe I heard you incorrectly, but do you equate standard, traditional, conservative thought with the moral majority? I mean, are they interchangeable?
There are
a lot of conservatives who do not hold what the moral majority is doing and wants to do, but the conservative thought has been in this country forever.
Yeah. I teach a course in conservatism in America, and there are, as far as I can tell, 21, you know, subspecies of conservatives, and there are about 40 on the left. So, and I'll grant you that. And there's a real battle there. But in American politics, it's funny. You can only, it comes down to a matter of, you know, having to vote really for one of two people, and you can say, well, you know, Reagan doesn't represent true conservatism. And then who does? Bill Buckley, or, you know, down the line, where do you go with this? You finally have to come to, well, you're not going to vote for the liberals, so you have to vote for the person who is more towards your kind of conservatism. And that's where, in a sense, I think that's a real strength of the American political system, because where you have what we call multi-party representation, you have real difficulty, because you're always having to put together, like in Israel is a classic case right now, you're having to put together coalitions. And in America, you know, like the British system, it's either one party or the other. And I think that's a real strength, although it means that you don't have this nice kind of ideological differentiation that you would like, and you leave that for, you know, academics like me to study.
And that's the classic example of the more left trying to tie a standard conservative to the more majority.
Yeah.
Because then the majority of the people will not support them.
Well, then, you know, if you want to argue on the other side, then you get on the, you know, Hubert Humphrey being soft on communism thing, you know, the charge on the left. And coming from Hubert Humphrey country, you know, that's difficult. I thought I saw a hand, back there, sure.
Doesn't President Reagan's tactics conduct like Reverend Jesse Jackson did? Doesn't that, his tactics make him an American white candidate?
Make him a which?
Doesn't he make him an American white candidate instead of
he's running that risk. My own, you know, this is my own personal feeling. I think the Republicans have written the black vote off. I really think so. It'd be my own particular interpretation right now. Reagan appeared last week with Bush down in the South again, and you know, you have to read the code things there. Like I said, that would be my interpretation. And we'll see what happens at the Republican convention. That's August 12th, isn't it? I think it starts in Dallas.
It's much later.
August.
Much later.
The 20th? I get home the 12th, and I want to have it in before class starts, so.
I think the Hispanic vote is the one that's untapped that they're going to go after.
Yeah.
Because nobody's really made it in, and they're in California, you know, you look at California.
Yeah, and Florida.
Yeah.
And in Florida, that's, yeah. And what Reagan has done, the Republicans have done clearly, very successfully, they know where the new source of power, political and economic, in this country is, and that's in the Sun Belt. Who needs, you know, Massachusetts anymore, or Maine, or any of the other countries, or Minnesota for that matter? The population, the votes, the, you know, the economic future is in the Sun Belt. And Kevin Phillips is a Republican political analyst who saw this clearly as early as 1976. And it's going to continue, I think, in that direction, because California is the largest state in terms of population now, and you know the industries are moving out. Our Governor Perpich is trying to hold them in Minnesota, but they're going Sun Belt. Even Tonka Toys has moved down to the Sun Belt, and for one reason, they don't have to put up with labor unions there. That's one major trend there. But I think the politics are there. One more question, and then I'm getting hungry. So,
do you think either party is going to worry much about the vote of gays?
Not of gays. There will be some mileage made because of what Jackson said at the, you know, in his Rainbow Coalition sort of thing, that who are the people in the Rainbow Coalition? And you remember he said that on national television. So there'll be some mileage back and forth there. On the women thing, I think clearly Ferrero is aimed at, you know, the women's vote. Sure. And that's what a vice president is all about. Back and forth. And the most obvious case of that was when JFK nominated LBJ for vice president in, you know, 1960. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And I don't know if